basically those allegations of corruption are weapons that the United States uses to slander Venezuela and try to delegitimize the Venezuelan government and the entire Bolivarian Revolution and all the radical changes that have been going on there. And, you know, of course, it uses the same almost white man's burdens kind of argument with Haiti, you know, basically saying, oh, the Haitians are not fit to govern themselves. You know, they need, you know, this powerful organization, this, you know, they need aid agencies, they need the UN, they need the United States, they need the IMF and stuff to hold their hand like they're tiny little children, and we will help them to develop, and they're incapable of standing on their own 2 feet. And we've seen this again and again and again. We saw this during the colonial period in Africa. We see this with regard to Africa today. We see this regard to like third world countries all around the world. That's the kind of rhetoric that gets employed, you know, by the IMF, World Bank, the United States, State Department, you know, you name it. They all try to justify, you know, say these people are not ready for self-determination. Meanwhile, these people have been fighting for self-determination for decades, for centuries even. You know, only to be repressed time and time again by the forces of empire. So the struggle really does go on in places like Venezuela and Haiti and Afghanistan, you know, struggle for self-determination. And that's going to keep going on. So I want to play this clip by Caleb Maupin, which he did on Community Public Radio in New York City. And he was recently in Venezuela to actually monitor the most recent elections. So he had a very interesting report, which he gave back. This is actually just before the vote was taken. So the results were not known yet. But it's very interesting what he had to say. So please stay tuned to Back in the USSR.
Caleb Maupin is an activist with the International Action Center and, as a journalist, is a frequent contributor to RT, Press TV, and the CPR News, among others. He's in Caracas for the election, and we spoke with him there via Skype Friday.
I am in Caracas.
All right. So tell us about, describe the scene there right now.
Well, yesterday was the closing of the campaign. There was a huge rally. Maduro gave a speech, urging people to go out and continue to support the revolution. The campaigning is officially over. The vote will take place on Sunday. And yesterday I saw an excellent presentation. We went to the National Center of the Elections, the CNE. And, we saw an amazing presentation. This is going to be a very, very democratic election. I would say that this election is going to be more transparent, more democratic, in its procedures than any election we've ever had in the United States. I mean, you can go down to the things they do for transparency, with making sure that the fingerprints match, that no one votes for anybody else. You can go to the fact they have proportional representation so that parties are represented. This is going to be a very, very fair election. By any standard of it.
And, we've heard, of course, that Capriles has already declared, essentially, that the right won the election and that if the left is declared the winner, then, out in the streets.
Well, exactly. And that's the game the opposition has played for the last 15 years, is never accept the election results and cause unrest and foment chaos in response to them. But the reality is, the right wing is not guaranteed a victory on Sunday. The reason for that being that they're very divided. The Chavista movement is united. They are backing the same candidates on the ballot. Many different parties, United Socialist Party, the PSUV, the Communist Party, the Fatherland for All Party, all these parties are backing the same candidates. They're offering a united voice for continuing the revolution. But the opposition is very divided. There are many different factions within the opposition, and they don't all agree. So just because things may be slightly leaning in their favor, that doesn't guarantee them an electoral victory. And we have to be very clear about that. And we also have to be clear that whatever happens, we know the right wing and the opposition, which is being funded by the United States, we know that they are going to try and foment chaos and unrest. That is what they generally do. They're going to try and cause trouble and really do everything they can to be disruptive. I mean, I've been seeing things in the U.S. media since I've come here that are just ridiculous. Ridiculous allegations are being made. And they're trying to do everything they can to just smear the election results and try to create an incident in the aftermath of the elections. But the people here here have really benefited from the revolution. I mean, the impact the revolution has had on people's lives is just very amazing. But I mean, we were at the center, the election center, and we saw how these elections are going to be done. And I was blown away by how democratic it is. I mean, could you imagine proportional representation, representing people voting for parties rather than for individuals, so that parties are assigned the number of seats they receive based on the percentage that they get? There's a number of parties on the ballot representing many different sections. There's an ecology party. There's all kinds of parties on the ballot. There's everything is being done to make sure the vote is completely transparent. This is going to be a fair election.
You know, it's not just important to the people in Venezuela. Venezuela sits at the heart of the ALBA countries. The ALBA countries sit at the heart of the regional integration project in Latin America and the Caribbean. And that, in turn, sits pretty close to the center of the growing multipolarity around the world. Do people there recognize how important this election really is?
Oh, it's extremely, extremely important, especially in light of what's happening in Brazil now with the impeachment proceedings against Dilma beginning, especially in light of the more right-wing moves in Argentina. This election is extremely important. What began here with Chavismo in 1999, with the beginning of the Bolivarian Revolution, I mean, this has impacted the entire continent, and it's impacted the entire world. I mean, people all over the world who are fighting for their independence and the fight against the rule of the world by big bankers and monopolists, they've been given a boost by what's happened here. And this election will have a global impact. And I think what's important to keep in mind is the people of this country are ready to defend their country. They're ready to defend their revolution. And if there is some kind of provocation in the aftermath of what will be a very democratic vote, I think the people who love this revolution and have gained greatly from it will defend their revolution. And I don't have any doubt about it. The people here, they love what has happened. People here have jobs. They have health care. I mean, we haven't seen any beggars the whole time we've been here. You know, and we've been to some of the poorest areas. We've seen just recently, you know, one thing that they're doing is they're building low-income housing. Using the oil money, they're building housing units. And by the end of the year, the goal is to have over 1 million low-income housing units built. And I've seen some of these low-income housing projects that have been built by the government. I mean, they're just beautiful, beautiful buildings that are being constructed. I mean, the priority of the Bolivarian government is the needs of the people. They're not putting the needs of the big bankers and corporations. They're putting the needs of the people first. And, the impact is really, really tremendous. And it's not only been good for the low-income people, it's even been good for the big corporations to get society in order, to get the chaos of the market out of the way. I mean, great gains have gone on. It's been very good for Venezuela's economy to have the Bolivarian Revolution. And I think the people of Venezuela will continue to defend that revolution, even if in the next few days we see some serious provocations.
And finally, because I know your time is short, you're both an activist and a journalist. And I'm wondering, what exactly are you doing while you're there?
Well, I intend to document what takes place here, because I can guarantee you that U.S. media is going to lie about what happens in the next few days. U.S. media never strays from their script about Chavez, the brutal dictator, Maduro, the brutal dictator. They never stray from this script, even though, you know, every election has been won legitimately, according to the Carter Center, the United Nations. They have a script, a narrative about a brutal dictatorship. It's just propaganda. It's a false narrative. I'm going to document what actually happens here in Venezuela. People are anticipating some kind of confrontation taking place in the street. We saw what happened last year, the La Salida campaign, where, you know, the far right was out in the street murdering people in response to Maduro's victory. And I intend to record what happens here and record the truth and let people know what's really going to happen in Venezuela, what's really happening, because people need to know what's going to happen. They will lie about this. They're already lying. I saw in the press, for example, they were saying that Maduro was saying that they would take to the streets and commit violence if the opposition won. Well, no, what he actually said was that the people of Venezuela will not allow a right-wing coup to happen and will march in the streets to defend their revolution. He didn't say they were going to engage in violence if the opposition won. I mean, just every little thing, every little distortion is being used. So I intend to document what's actually taking place.
Me falta el aire. Y el corazón tucum tucum tucum. Hoy va a correr sangre. Ya sé por dónde se mueve según. Hoy voy a convertirme en un criminal. Ya no creo en nadie a menos que me convierta en un muerto. Hoy voy a vengar a mi hermano como le juré a mi padre. Diente por diente, ojo por ojo, es esto. Una bicha prestada porque no soy AMPA. Pero la rabia que siento no escampa. Es tanta que me ahoga. Nunca había huelido droga. Pero ahora es necesario para cumplir con lo que el corazón me implora. Siento que se me sale el tórax. La moto a 100 por hora. Pelo por la bicha y le grito y ahora. Todo pasa muy chola en ráfaga. Descargo a todos esos malandros hasta que ya no escupe la pistola. Y el corazón tucum 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 tucum. Y la bala pa'caun 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 pa'caun. Y el corazón tucum 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 tucum. Y la bala pa'caun pa'caun pa'caun. Ey. Lloro de la rechera mientras en la acera calgo. Escucho una señora que grita que mataron a Carlos. Solo ahí fue cuando sonreí aliviado porque Carlos fue el bastardo que mató a mi hermano. Todo es confuso, escucho wiu, wiu, wiu. No veo bien y siento frío, frío, frío. Un tipo gritando el mío, el mío, el mío. Hasta que ya no escuché nada más que un profundo silencio. Profundo silencio. Varios segundos de calma mi alma al lado de mi cuerpo. Me dije, aún no he ido al más allá. Siento un olor a perfume, veo una luz en un túnel. Un fuego que me consume, se empezaba a ver atrás. No dejaré que me abrume el fuego, seguiré hacia el túnel. Pensé, pero seguir no pude porque me alaron para atrás. Cayendo en pica, montañas negras de azufre con un olor a mierda. Cuerpos deformados que sufren, caí sobre una piedra. Un barco viejo con un viejo me esperaba. No me respondían nada, almas el barco golpeaban. Él me llevó donde Cerbero, que dijo no morderme porque le guste a mi nombre de rapero. Si lo ves de esta forma, pude tener suerte irónica en la vida, pero también irónica es la muerte. Me desperté ya sentado sobre un estrado y un jurado de malvados decidiría mi suerte. Recuerdo que fui golpeado y trasladado a un sitio en uno de los círculos con un montón de gente. Por vengativo y asesino, te quemarás por siempre, por toda la eternidad como castigo. Vi muchos rostros conocidos y me sentí sorprendido porque no pensé que estuvieran conmigo. Personas que lucían buenas en el mundo, como el Che Guevara, incluso como Juan Pablo II. Presuntos Dalai Lama, calcinados Jomao y los difuntos Teferi Maconen y Beethoven juntos. Me asombró mucho saber que estaban aquí John F. Kennedy, Lenin, Mahoma y Joseph Smith. César y Napoleón salieron de la llama porque eran la misma persona que ahora es un tal Obama. No entendía nada, pregunté por Cristo y noté que se burlaban porque nadie lo había visto. Otros dijeron que fue un truco de su iglesia para gobernar el mundo con su majestuosa empresa. Charles Russell y Washington, José de San Martín y Gandhi, Yasser Arafat, Cristóbal Colón, Isabel de Inglaterra transformada en perra desnuda. Supe incluso estaban Bolívar y Buda. Son demasiadas dudas, pensamientos vagos, gente buena en el infierno o es que en algo fueron malos. Por algo están aquí, aunque no lo acepten. Debo hallar ahora una manera de huir de la muerte. Recordé que en la tierra donde había nacido existía una leyenda del diablo con un tal Florentino. Obviamente un cuento, pero inteligente para irme de este infierno. Infierno literalmente. Vociferé durante meses que podía con el jefe recitando versos entre fuego y heces. Hasta que un día apareció un viejo con traje que me dijo pierde y me llevo a tu padre de homenaje. Qué situación tan complicada en la que me encontraba. Pero yo nunca he sido de los que se cagan. Además, había compuesto demasiados versos que más la improvisación harían temblar al universo. Empieza antes que nada te maldigo o hacer que sufras el peor de todos los castigos. ¿Cómo te atreves a retarme en castellano y en este ritmo tan pobre como el suelo donde te has criado? Con más razón tú deberías avergonzarte, perder un combate con un homo sapien. Además te explico, se llama Venezuela donde nació este tipo y tú no puedes maldecirme porque ya yo estoy maldito. Eres muy peculiar y mi deber es explicar que no puedes ganar porque yo lo sé todo. Domino los idiomas, los modos, la historia. Incluso sé los más recónditos miedos de tu memoria. Debo aclarar que hay un factor clave que olvidas. Los miedos se van en el momento en que pierdes la vida. Se dice que el amor masacra tus insultos, pero yo te mataré con más odio para ser justo. A mí tú no me engañas, mediocre adversario. ¿Cómo hablar de odio si tu brazo grita lo contrario? Tú le has mentido a todos tus seguidores con múltiples contradicciones en muchas de tus canciones. No entienden nada los humanos. Yo sueño con amor porque sé que en el fondo nosotros amamos. Si canto rabia es para desahogar por dentro, como cuando Cristo echó a los comerciantes de su templo. De nuevo hablando tú de cosas que no sabes. Eres un imitador como tu voz, la cual no es tan grave. Lo único grave es que te crean. Pero aunque la mentira tiene patas, tarde o temprano cojea. Me has conmovido ahora que te conozco más, Satanás.
No comprendes el arte, tampoco la paz. Mi voz es más, esta es mi voz que Dios me dio de don para tenaz usar la cual daga en tu corazón. ¿Cómo puedes hablar de Dios si eres ateo? En tus ojos lo veo mientras mi candela te consume. Te recuerdo que Dios no existe y lo que viste en aquel túnel no fue más que simples ángeles comunes. Dudar y no creer es algo muy distinto, y si dudo de Dios es porque no lo he visto. Aún así insisto en recalcarte lo que contigo aprendí, que reyes habrán muchos, pero siempre tienes que ir a ti. Y el corazón tucum, tucum, tucum. Y el corazón tucum, 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 tucum. Y el corazón tucum, 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 tucum. Y el corazón tucum, 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 tucum.
You're listening to Back in the USSR here on 93.3 FM CFRU. So that was Canto Biero with Ezapico, and that is actually a Venezuelan rapper right there who is performing. And of course, we had Caleb Maupin talking about the various ways that imperialism has tried to sabotage the Venezuelan electoral process both this year and, of course, in the past, and the reasons why that has been done, like to subvert the self-determination of the Venezuelan people in the interest of empire. Now, I want to talk a little bit about Syria. I really don't have time to go into it tonight as much as it deserves, as much as this massive subject deserves in the world today. So I think what I'll do is I'll talk more about that next week. I originally was going to play an interview with Eric Dreitzer of StopImperialism.com, who, you know, but of course the interview is like about 50 minutes long, even though he had an amazing analysis of the recent events going on in Syria. But more or less what's going on the ground in Syria right now is that the Syrian Arab Army, backed by Hezbollah and backed by, you know, various Iraqi aligned forces and by Iran and by Russia, have been increasingly driving back the U.S.-backed militants in Syria, and very impressive gains have been made in the provinces of Aleppo, at Latakia, in Homs, in Dara, in Damascus countryside. All these areas, like the death squads, the U.S.-backed proxy forces on the ground, and the forces backed by Turkey and by Saudi Arabia and these other U.S. client states in the region. These forces are getting pushed back. They're losing ground. They're basically on the run. And that is very, very good news. Now, we see how recently, how Turkey shot down a Russian airplane along the border with the northern border with Syria. And there was all these claims about it violating Turkish airspace and Turkey had to act and this kind of thing. You know, there's like virtually no evidence of that. And if it did enter Turkish airspace, it only did there basically for a few seconds before going back into Syria. So basically, this was an act of provocation on the part of Turkey, a NATO member, trying to undermine the Russian presence in Syria. You know, the Russians were, of course, invited in by the Syrian government to support the Syrian government against the threat that it faces on the ground. And they've basically been providing close air support to the Syrian army and assisting it as it advances. Unlike the U.S. airstrikes, which more or less have just been targeting civilian infrastructure and have resulted in mass civilian casualties. The Russian Air Force basically is really targeting the U.S.-backed forces in Syria on the ground, you know, as, you know, striking military targets. And this is why the United States has been so opposed to it. You know, and there's been a rising rhetoric against Russian involvement in this sort of thing. So, I mean, and of course, increasingly evidence has emerged that the Turkey has been backing the Islamic State, backing ISIS, you know, routing illegal trade in oil through its territory, smuggling in weapons and guns and all this sort of thing. So, and that there are vested interests within Turkey that want to keep that open, that want to keep that smuggling open, keep the rat lines, so to speak, going with regard to between the terrorist organizations and their suppliers in Turkey, you know, which are CIA backed. We've known that as far back as 2012. The New York Times even admitted the CIA was on the ground in Turkey supplying arms, supplying weapons to various terror groups in Syria. So more or less, this is a proxy war, the same as the Contra war against the Nicaraguan people was in the 1980s. You know, where, of course, you had the United States backing reactionary forces, you know, drug cartels, including, to destabilize and destroy the revolutionary government in Venezuela, in Nicaragua, in the 1980s, and how violent that got. And basically, we see like a process on an even larger scale going on in Syria, where the Syrian nation is being undermined through the most brutal violence imaginable at the hands of U.S.-supported forces that have infiltrated the country and are trying to basically take it down. You know, and those forces are also operational in Iraq. And we've seen recently how the Iraqis have really been trying to extract themselves from American influence and really trying to assert themselves, their independence, their self-determination, especially now that Turkey has actually illegally crossed into northern Iraq with soldiers and set up a military base there against the wishes of the Iraqi government. And increasingly, the Iraqi government is really on collision course with the United States in the same way. You know, trying to preserve its solidarity in the face of empire. So, I mean, this all this stuff is going on, and it's very important to understand the real story in that region, because, I mean, there's so much distortion, there's so many lies, there's so many, you know, these so-called human rights crusaders that go around and they want to oust the Syrian government and this sort of thing, and they basically are backing Western intervention in that country. You know, we really need to still be on the lookout for these humanitarian imperialists, these so-called humanitarian interventionists. Those people need to be stopped. They're just as barbaric as the neocons and these other various imperialist forces in the United States and other Western countries. And they also produce, like, horrific... Their policies produce destroyed nations and horrific body counts and basically colonized peoples and populations and make this world safe for the Fortune 500 and hellish and unlivable for the rest of us. You know, that's why they need to be opposed. This is basically an issue of class. This is an issue of self-determination. This is an issue of struggle against imperialism. And that really needs to be kept in mind with regard to Syria. Now, on a different note, I really want to kind of close the show out by talking about... I had the opportunity to watch Trumbo, the movie Trumbo, last night about Dalton Trumbo, one of the... a screenwriter in Hollywood in the 1940s and 50s who was a communist. He was blacklisted in the McCarthy era. He went to jail. He was forced to basically go underground and operate under pseudonyms for quite some time, even as he wrote some of the greatest movie scripts, you know, like for movies like Spartacus and Exodus and The Brave One, all these Oscar-winning kind of material. You know, he never compromised. He always maintained his convictions. You know, he never backed away from communism. He never renounced it. He always, like, stayed true to who he was and to, like, what he believed and, like, the kind of struggles that working people face in the world as they fight for control over their own lives against the capitalist class, against the people exploiting them. And he was very sensitive to that. And they came out in the scripts he wrote. He's a very brave man. And so what I really want to do now is I want to play a something which recently came out on the Empire Files with Abby Martin on Telesur, which is actually a Venezuelan channel, talking about anti-communism in the United States, resistance to anti-communism in the United States, and how... And how really the and really what this says about, like, struggling against imperialism, struggling against class oppression. So I'm going to play that now. So please stay tuned to Back in the USSR. We'll be right back.
From a young age, we're taught fidelity to the system and to the state. We all grow up saying the Pledge of Allegiance in school, but the words "under God" we take for granted.
Those words were added to the Pledge of Allegiance in 1954 to exclude American communists. Communists, of course, are godless heathens.
That piece of history is largely unknown, but the ideology behind it is probably the most known idea in American society.
This town may appear to be an accurate likeness of a typical American community, but it's a fraud. It isn't free.
Socialism has spread the shadow of human regimentation over most of the nations of the earth, and the shadow is encroaching upon our own liberty.
If a person defends the activities of communist nations while consistently attacking the domestic and foreign policy of the United States, she may be a communist.
Now that you've become acquainted with the enlightened communist system, in contrast to the outdated capitalistic way of life, you are now prepared for the next step of your indoctrination.
You won't have to worry about next year. The state will do your planning from now on.
Overthrow it by force and violence. We'll have our way if it means bloodshed and terror.
Because the news about communism is getting around. And it's only another word for slavery.
In almost every industrialized country in the world, socialist parties have huge representations, large membership bodies, and hold many elected seats in government. But in America, everyone knows that being called a socialist or communist carries an immediate negative connotation. The term is frequently used to smear people in groups, not necessarily for being one, but merely for associating with one. So what is this unacceptable ideology?
To find out, I talked to a founder of a socialist organization in the United States, the Party for Socialism and Liberation, and longtime socialist organizer Brian Becker.
People think Karl Marx was the originator of socialism, maybe modern socialism, but you look at early Christianity, early Islam, the early tenets of Judaism. A lot of it has a yearning for the old days, the yearning to go back to primary or social existence where there's cooperation and equality. Socialism is the ideology reflecting the desire by people who want change, people who want to get rid of the evils and the injustices of the capitalist society and replace it with a new society, a society based on public ownership. And public ownership means that instead of the corporations and the banks and the wealth, all that which is created by the labor of human beings, working people, instead of that wealth being accrued and accumulated by a small percentage, it is used for society's needs. In the United States Constitution, people are given political rights. The homeless get the right to vote every 2 or 4 years, but they don't have the right to a home. The socialist program is everyone must have the right to employment or an income if they can't work. Everyone, as a guaranteed constitutional right, must have a place to live that's affordable. And health care should be free, and education should be free. Now, those four things that's the hallmark of the socialist program, that's been demonized, but if you ask most American people, certainly the have-nots, they'll think, yeah, those are pretty good things.
And what are socialism's roots here in America?
Well, socialism has very deep roots in America. Most Americans don't know it, but the rise of the kindergarten, the rise of public education, the rise of something called Social Security, that is when you retire and are no longer productive, no longer able to be employed by a capitalist productively, you should not be living a life of poverty, Social Security. The idea of unemployment insurance, meaning when you're laid off, not for any fault of your own, but because the capitalist system routinely goes through economic recessions and depressions, you should be cared for by an unemployment insurance. These are the ideas that originated with the socialist movement.
In the late 1800s, there was an intense battle between organized labor and the country's industrial capitalists. With socialists in the leadership, the labor movement was on the cusp of winning the 8-hour workday. And the corporate owners were willing to do anything to keep working their workers to the bone. Workers on strike all over were shot and killed by police during this fight for what seems like such a basic human right today. In 1887, 7 anti-capitalist leaders in the movement were sentenced to death on trumped-up charges, 4 of them publicly hanged. It was a clear message to anyone involved in radical politics.
The battling ideologies of capitalism and socialism in America is more than just opposing arguments. It's been a real battle with real weapons, where one side was exiled, sent to prison, and murdered.
anti-communist paranoia continued to build. Struggles that outraged the rich, like child labor laws and women's right to vote, were labeled red plots. President Woodrow Wilson was helping push for new laws that officially criminalized opinions, not deeds. In 1915, in his State of the Union address, he declared, "There are citizens of the United States who have poured the poison of disloyalty in the very arteries of our national life, who have sought to bring the authority and good name of our government into contempt. Such creatures of passion, disloyalty, and anarchy must be crushed out." And the mission to crush out anti-capitalist ideas was in full effect as World War I began. A coalition of socialists and anarchists who had been leading the militant labor and anti-war struggle was a primary target. Over 90 IWW leaders were mass arrested and given lengthy prison sentences. Repression in the courts was reinforced by hired gangs and lynch mobs allowed by the state to carry out vigilante actions. In 1917, the oil company-controlled newspaper Tulsa World printed on its front page, "The first step in whipping Germany is to strangle the IWWs. Kill them, just as you would kill any other kind of snake." And they did kill them. And that year alone, big business's thugs like the Pinkerton Gang lynched many IWW leaders. Frank Little, a popular IWW leader of mine workers in Butte, Montana, was beaten, dragged behind a car, and hanged from a railroad trestle. That same year, Wilson legislated the criminalization of dissent by passing the Espionage Act. Included in the U.S. government's sweeping definition of espionage, suggesting that you shouldn't be used as cannon fodder in a war between ruling elites. In 1918, famous American socialist and presidential candidate Eugene Debs gave a speech in Canton, Ohio. He said, "Wars throughout history have been waged for conquest and plunder. The feudal barons of the Middle Ages, the economic predecessors of the capitalists of our day, declared all wars, and their miserable serfs fought all battles. Taught to revere their masters, to believe that when their masters declared war upon one another, it was their patriotic duty to fall upon one another and to cut one another's throats for the profit and glory of the lords and barons. They alone declare war, yours not to reason why, yours but to do and die. If war is right, let it be declared by the people. You, who have your lives to lose, you certainly, above all others, have the right to decide the momentous issue of war or peace." For these words alone, Debs was arrested, convicted, and sentenced to 10 years in prison. The charge? Obstructing recruitment. Many others who did nothing but speak against the war met the same fate. During the patriotic hysteria, the Espionage Act was expanded into the most repressive law in U.S. history. The Sedition Act read, "Whoever shall willfully utter, print, write, or publish any disloyal, profane, scurrilous, or abusive language about the form of government of the United States, or the military or naval forces of the United States, or advocate, teach, defend, or suggest the doing of any of the acts, shall be punished." Over 1,500 people were arrested under this law. Those convicted faced up to 20 years in prison. Everything and everyone was a target. Books and feature films were seized by the government. Every postmaster in the country was under orders to monitor all mail and refuse to mail newspapers and magazines deemed unloyal. Despite this repression, major victories were still won. During World War I, workers were able to win higher wages. But after the war, their bosses wanted those wages back. The captains of industry in America had just watched peasants and industrial workers in Russia rise to power. It had reverberations everywhere. People all over the U.S. stood up to the attacks on their jobs and wages. In a wave of strikes in 1919, one out of every five workers in America walked off the job. The display of power was formidable. U.S. Attorney General Mitchell Palmer, a member of the progressive wing of the Democratic Party, along with the Justice Department head, the young J. Edgar Hoover, mounted the capitalists' counteroffensive. Palmer wrote in The Case Against the Reds. Like a prairie fire, the blaze of revolution was sweeping over every American institution of law and order a year ago. It was eating its way into the homes of the American workmen. Its sharp tongues of revolutionary heat were licking the altars of the churches, leaping to the belfry of the school bell, crawling into the sacred corners of American homes, seeking to replace marriage vows with libertine laws, burning up the foundations of society. While they have caused irritating strikes, and while they've infected our social ideas with the disease of their own minds and their unclean morals, we can get rid of them. On November 7th, 1919, a date chosen to mark the anniversary of the Russian Revolution, a series of violent raids, without warrants, took place in 12 American cities, arresting hundreds. Months later, on January 2nd, raids took place in more than 30 cities involving federal, state, and local law enforcement. Every single socialist office was raided. Homes of socialists were also raided. Around 10,000 people were rounded up and thrown in jail in Palmer and Hoover's raids. Thousands of resident immigrants were deported for being communists. The raids became notorious for their extreme brutality. Such a massive operation dealt a huge blow to the socialist movement and was a clear message of terror to anyone who considered joining a socialist group. Similar state-sanctioned violent repression of socialists continued in the following years. Police departments formed official Red Squads, where police intelligence units working with business elites unleashed terror on party members. They conducted mass surveillance, raided their meetings, and ransacked their offices. As a Los Angeles police commissioner said in defense of their Red Squad in the 30s, the more the police beat them up and wrecked their headquarters, the better. Communists have no constitutional rights. Why did socialism become so strong and also so demonized and attacked at the late 19th century and early 20th century?
Well, it was really about power. The socialist movement started to arise when the ugliness of urban, proletarian, or bourgeois society, the working of 14, 16 hours a day, the working of children to the bone, the working of people so that they died at a tender age because they worked so long, those kind of oppressions suffered by the modern working family, that gave rise to a socialist movement. People who said, we work all day and for what? So that the capitalists, the big robber barons can get ever richer. We want ours. And that was the beginning both of the union movement and the beginning of socialist movements, socialist newspapers, and socialist parties in the United States.
Despite repression over those decades, socialism in America still flourished. In 1912, there were 13 daily socialist newspapers, 12 monthlies, and 298 different weekly socialist publications. Eugene Debs, who ran for president on the platform of making the United States a socialist country, won 6% of the vote, over 7 million votes by today's population, and at a time when women and African Americans were barred from the ballot box. Debs' party, the Socialist Party, had 118,000 active members. The Communist Party, which had 8,000 members in 1929, swelled to 100,000 in just 10 years. Beloved figures embraced and joined Communist parties, such as Langston Hughes, Pete Seeger, and Helen Keller. Between 1898 and 1933, there were 57 different socialist mayors elected in 23 states, from Nebraska to Florida to New Jersey. In 1911 alone, 74 different U.S. cities and towns elected socialists as mayor or major officers. Still small relative to the population size, socialists in America made themselves felt by Wall Street with their militancy and uncompromising class consciousness. Fearing losing their power altogether, the empire's kingpins granted major concessions with the New Deal to try to quell the workers' rebellion. The movement at home wasn't the only thing scaring the elites. A rapidly changing world catapulted the repression.
That was a response by the elites in America to the Bolshevik Revolution. Here in Russia, you had poor people in the cities and in the countryside take the power, hold the power, and say that they're a socialist government. That inspired socialists all over the world. Socialists started in China and Vietnam and Korea, but also in America. And so the government came down heavy with the Palmer raids to say, we're not going to tolerate a generalized radical resistance as evidenced by the Russian Revolution. So what happened in 1917 was the ruling class in America was panic-stricken. It was stricken with the idea that this contagion of revolution could spread to the poor within the United States, and that if they could organize themselves, if they could have a space to organize, then they could succeed as they did in Russia. From a historical point of view, I think it's really good to remember that when the Haitian Revolution happened, the slaves in Haiti, the first slave revolution, it had a panic impact on American, the American capitalist class, which at that time was a slave-owning ruling class. When George Washington and his Secretary of State, Thomas Jefferson, rushed money to the beleaguered white racist regime in Haiti to stop the Haitian Revolution in the 1790s. And in 1804, there was a kind of Red Scare at that time where all black people in the South had their movements restricted because there was a fear that the contagion of revolution from Haiti to the southern states in the United States could lead to a slave revolution.
The era of anti-communism that followed World War II was fierce.
In 1946, Congress passed the Taft-Hartley Act. It was an unprecedented purge of socialist union members, of which there were many. Up until this point, half of the unions in America were under the leadership of socialists. But with the new law, every single union officer was required to sign an affidavit pledging that they did not believe in socialism. If you didn't sign, you lost your job. Knowing that art could dangerously convey ideas, the government wanted to have tight control over that, too. In 1947, the House Committee on Un-American Activities began to target people in the entertainment industry. Dangerous professions such as screenwriters, actors, directors, producers, technicians, authors, musicians, and others were all summoned to Congress and forced to publicly swear that they were not communist. Those who said they were barred from employment and blacklisted in Hollywood. But you didn't even have to say you were to get punished. You just had to assert your rights. Like the 10 screenwriters and directors who took a stand against the nationwide witch hunt.
We are aware of a developing nightmare of fear in our land, in which increasing numbers of citizens are being forced to swear, I am not this, I am not that, I don't belong to anything, I don't believe in anything, I don't criticize anything.
Loyalty oaths and loyalty boards, and nobody is loyal who criticizes the bipartisan foreign policy. Thought control entering the university campuses. Educators being fired. Film studios enlisting in the Cold War. Labor leaders being framed on perjured testimony. Lawyers sent to prison for defending their clients.
All 10 decided that when asked if they were communist, they would refuse to answer. All 10 were sent to prison. For those who were open communists, well, they were just arrested. Under the Smith Act, it was deemed illegal for anyone to be a member of the Communist Party. And in a surprise attack, the state arrested everyone who held a leadership position in the party. All of them were sent to prison. Over 100 were convicted of being communists and given sentences of up to 6 years, jailed for nothing but their beliefs. During this period, 5,000 communists were forced to flee the country. More than 1,000 went to prison. The climate was such that anyone who even leaned to the left was completely persecuted. But just to show how far it would take things in the legal system, the U.S. government went beyond hard prison sentences. In 1951, Communist Party members Julius and Ethel Rosenberg were found guilty of being spies. But their sentences would be much different than their predecessors. The judge convicted them not for espionage, but for the murder of all the American soldiers who had been sent to die in Korea. On June 19, 1953, they were executed.
It seems like there had been waves of anti-communism before World War II, and after World War II, it seemed like anti-communism was pretty much locked in. How did the Cold War impact the repression on the left here at home?
After World War II, you had Soviet Union got stronger, China had its revolution, Vietnam had a revolution. Revolutions were happening all over the world against colonialism. So the U.S. elites, bankers, politicians, and of course the repressive agency said, we're going to stop that in its track in the United States. We're not going to let it flower. Communism after World War II became synonymous with the struggle against the Soviet Union. Communism was treated no longer as an indigenous movement for social progress and social justice and equality, but a fifth column, an extension of an enemy state. And of course, the U.S. and the Soviet Union had nuclear weapons pointed at each other. So if you were a communist, if you were sympathetic to the Soviet Union, sympathetic to socialism, then you were a traitor and you were treated as such. And that's what happened. Tens of thousands of people lost their jobs. Hundreds of thousands of people were driven out of industry. People decided then and there, I won't sign a petition, I won't go to a demonstration, I won't have anything to do with the left, because if I do, I could ruin my chances for employment or education, and it could impact my entire family. That's what actually happened in the United States. The United States government has a lot of power. The U.S. media, the corporate-owned media, has represented the view of the United States to the letter. And so the witch hunt that began in 1945, 46, 47, McCarthyism, became what I would say the unofficial religion of the United States. It was an article of faith. You had to swear that you renounced the devil, renounced communism, renounced socialism, so that you could work, so that you could have a career, so that you could thrive in any possible way. It became a rule for existence in the United States. And so you had not only censorship, but self-censorship. Millions of people decided, I'm just not going to identify as a socialist or a communist, even if I think those thoughts, because I can't survive within this system.
The vicious anti-communism of the 40s and 50s effectively snuffed out the left in the big cities, where the movement had always been strong. Finally, the plutocrats felt safe from the pitchforks.
But a challenge to the system's white supremacy suddenly reared its head in the rural South. In Montgomery, Alabama, a new mass movement was born. The state used its weapons of red-baiting, violence, and imprisonment, waging an all-out assault on those who wouldn't accept the status quo.
It was used as a tactic to negatively demonize people in the black liberation struggle. So, and it was effective. So if black leaders or organizations started to become too popular or too radical, they were labeled as red or communist, and that brought the state down on them. It made it more difficult for them to organize even within their own communities because of the negative propaganda associated with communism.
To what extent did the state go to suppress black liberation movements in the 60s and 70s?
The state was involved in any number of physical attacks on black liberation leaders and organizations, from shootouts with the Black Panther Party, straight out assassinations of leaders like Dr. King and Malcolm X, both of whom have had their high profile assassinations with strong documentation decidedly attached to this state being involved, directly or indirectly. Political imprisonment is still rampant. Many of those who were involved in those struggles are still locked down in the dungeons of the United States to this day. For their involvement, the counterintelligence program, as it was famously called, was developed specifically to wipe out all manner of the left and was targeted directly, specifically at the black liberation struggle.
Why do you think the most radical left and socialist elements of these figures are left out of the narrative?
You know, I was in a letter writing exchange with a political prisoner, David Gilbert, not long ago, one of the still imprisoned white members of the black liberation struggle. And this question came up, and his response is one I tend to agree with, that the scientific element of the struggle was attacked so that we would be left with nothing but those engaged in mysticism and other forms of organizing and leadership, that is, so that all of those who are engaged in the hardcore science of understanding how capitalism works, how imperialism works, how violence and media associated with those enterprises work, and who decidedly put in their program a redistribution of goods and services and targeted the economic structures that continue to create the inequality that we still deal with. All of those people were attacked and still are attacked, if not physically in their life or through imprisonment, holding their physical body. Their memories and their ideas are attacked posthumously. Even after death, those who were hostile to the state will be turned into, as I think Lenin called them, sycophants of the state in their afterlife. And their memories will be distorted to have them be propped up as one who would have supported what was going on when, in fact, they dedicated their entire life to destroying it.
The government's offensive with COINTELPRO was devastating. targeted all socialist organizations and black liberation groups. It worked to put spies in every single black student union and every college. Tens of thousands had their homes ransacked by the FBI. Through this mass surveillance operation, the government used a wrecking ball of infiltration, sabotage, and even assassinations. But it wasn't just here. The United States launched military interventions in over 17 countries in the name of fighting communism, deciding the destiny and causing untold misery for millions. With the collapse of the Soviet Union, the capitalists of the world declared the end of history, that capitalism had finally triumphed over socialism and would bury it forever. But if history has taught them anything, it's that even though they scorched the fields that grew socialist ideas, those seeds, though sometimes dormant, would sprout again. So we've been seeing something interesting recently, which is a presidential candidate gaining wide popular support who's a self-proclaimed socialist. I mean, what does this tell us about the new era that we're in?
The Soviet Union collapsed 23 years ago. The pretext for fighting communism as part of an international fight against an enemy state, that's gone. That's vanished. Capitalism can no longer compare itself to the Soviet Union. It can only compare itself to itself. And we see within the capitalist society a growing hardship, growing income inequality, growing poverty. One out of every two Americans lives in or near poverty. And so as a consequence of this economic division and the inability to justify the old anti-communism, there's new space opening up for socialism. And you see the Occupy movement. People said, we are the 99%. That was kind of the harbinger of the beginning of a new socialist context. The Sanders campaign, even though I don't agree with Bernie Sanders on many issues, the fact that tens of thousands of people come to someone who says he's a self-proclaimed socialist and says there should be an end to income inequality, that there should be greater equality, the fact that he's on the front cover of Time magazine and it says socialize this, comma, America, and that's not a bad thing, that means we're seeing a new day. The fog of anti-communism, the bigotry, the prejudice, that's starting to lift. And the Sanders campaign's success, surprising success, or the Occupy movement's sudden, spontaneous growth nationwide, these are harbingers of what's coming.
This war on ideas and alternatives is still being relentlessly pursued every day. Even 50 years after the Cold War, the empire continues to wage war on every remaining country trying to build up socialism, refusing to let even one nation develop alternatives without the constant threat of subversion and overthrow. Because the last thing the system wants is an example that undermines its supreme truth.
The inability to question this dogma is deeply ingrained. After all, capitalism is the bedrock of America. Like every other myth that acts as the glue to our society, this too needs to be challenged.
The planet is in deep crisis, where war and inequality define our world. Unfettered capitalism and endless consumption cannot and will not last. The elite at the helm won't ever give up their security for the good of humanity. And the old guard will use every weapon in its arsenal to maintain domination.
The Empire's long war against any alternative that challenges this crushing reality is unconscionable. We have the right to criticize the system itself without being labeled shut down or worse. We can't let the rulers of this system dictate the boundaries of our discussion. Because in this era, where alternatives are desperately needed, we have to unite to marginalize their ideas, not let them marginalize ours.
I'm the one. This is why we fight, why we die away. This is why we fight. And when we die, we will die with our This is why, this is why we fight. When we die, we will die with our arms unbound. This is why, this is why we fight. So come to me, come to me now. Lay your arms around me. This is why, this is why we fight. Come now, come how, come how, come how.
Classic boom bap blast, bazooka rap shit. I'm sending heads into backspin, attack with wind at the back, plus vernaculars to dig it back by facts. Packed with the stat charts and graphs, I got passion. Burn mics up to ashes, I make fascists clap their pants. Stanzas cure cultural cancer. I got tunes that move you to dance. Burn flags, anthem, throw a tantrum. Getting out of hand with these random acting tactics against the axis. My word act like nominally gat, rhymingly packed. Punch, crash the fun by metric tons and plus my math. Distribute cash among the classes. Take from the thieving greedy bastard. Give back like church hats to get past. Collapse structure, fuck facades. I destruct the support beams and bars. Wrecking ball large, resistance, subversive diction. Flip the shit just like a brick throne. Dethrone kings, bring the trees on. My tone rock like Gibraltar pop. Hip hop hotter than a rocket shot. I'm crime, think, thought, bring the big dog. Teach you to flee from the flock, walk off, switch shit. Hit my target, drop like bombs in the form of carpets. I got the target locked on that all shit. Pump your fist if you know where we are. That's a rap, boom bap, original rap at. Take it to back, boom bap, boom bap. I'm talking true path, master the craft. The pupil, the prof, keep dropping math. Boom bap, blast the bazooka rap. Boom bap, original rap.